Thanks, Kim. And hello, everyone. We're glad you've joined us on this second week of our Word and Life series, Healing the Heart of Democracy. I am imagining you all sitting in this huge Zoom auditorium, stretching from California to Florida and points in between. So in order to gather all of us along the same wavelength of mind and spirit, let's set her down just for a moment or two using our breath and the tides of the little green piece video that Tim will pop up so that we come into coherence and readiness together. So let's begin with the video as soon as Tim cues it, and we'll breathe rhythmically together. Now we're in sync with earth, with breath, and with each other, and ready for what's in store for us this morning. Last week, we learned that we are wired as a species to function in groups, and that we're programmed with six moral imperatives that underwrite all healthy social survival. These six foundational precepts of right behaviors produce the moral cohesiveness of healthy tribes and well-working nations. But over the last few decades, our country has morphed into an uneasy plurality of subcultures and a plurality of moral sets and belief systems. Our mass media amplifies our fixation on our own rightness and the wrongness of others that has begun to produce a culture of contempt. And that's the first part of the title of the source book that we'll be drawing from for the next couple of weeks. Its author, Arthur Brooks, investigates how we've begun to demonize each other and goes on to offer an unconventional prescription to bring America together. We're very fortunate this morning to have at our Zoom podium two speakers whose careers and wide experience combine to understand and unmask this culture of contempt, and to show us how to move beyond it. Let me tell you a little about who they are. I think you're looking at Reverend Bart Tarman, who is an ordained Presbyterian minister who has served in ministry for 50 years. He was an associate pastor at El Montecito Presbyterian Church for 5 years and the chaplain of Westmont College for 18 years. After that, he and his wife served in an international ministry for several years. They returned to Santa Barbara 12 years ago and have served as pastor of the Summerland Presbyterian Church ever since. Bart's main emphasis during these years has been teaching on the person and precepts of Jesus. 5 years ago, on his 66th birthday, Bart began the spiritual pilgrimage of hiking the Camino de Santiago in northern Spain. This year, he and his wife, Linda, who is a spiritual director herself, teaching at Still Point, celebrated 50 years of marriage with their circle of children, grandchildren, and adopted grandchildren. Bart is also a professional artist whose water media landscapes have been shown in galleries and art shows around Santa Barbara. His partner this morning is Dr. Thomas Jayawardena, a professor of sociology at Westmont. Thomas earned his doctorates from the University of Surrey in the UK, the International University for Social Studies in Rome, and licentiates in sacred theology and philosophy there as well, and then another doctorate at the Goethe Institute in Munich. He has taught at Purdue, Harvard, the University of Nigeria, at St. Peter's College in Sri Lanka, and the University of Surrey before coming to Westmont College here in Montecito. His specialization is in third world studies, researching in the fields of youth employment, unemployment and terrorism, cross-cultural communication studies, inequality and global development, and the sociology of religion. He co-founded the Children of Joy Orphanage in Sri Lanka and has been involved in numerous international charitable organizations over the years. So here are Bart and Thomas, ready to tackle the culture of contempt with the outlandish notion of loving your enemies. Take it away, Tom and Bart.
Great. Well, thank you. It's great to be with all of you. As you know, I've been a part of Word and Life for numbers of years, as my wife, and it's odd being here with you all on Zoom, I can say that. Let's see, are you hearing me? Yeah. Everybody hearing me? Okay.
Yep.
I'm just going to put mine on a little different view here. There we go. So, I'd like to start by telling you, my good friend Thomas, whenever I hear his introduction, I think we should just cut me short and put him on. He has such a wealth of life experience and academic credentials. But beyond that, he's one of the most honestly humble and down-to-earth people I know, which is probably his greatest character trait. Thomas and I decided I would teach for about 15 minutes or so, and then I'd turn it over to him, and he would teach for 15 or 20 minutes, and then we'd go into our groups and then come back out, and we'll either follow up on some of that or we'll just field questions. So that's kind of how we're seeing this time. This book was given to me a year before this gathering of Word and Life, you know, Love Your Enemies by Arthur Brooks. And I had never read it. It was given to me by Anna Grotenhaus. And she gave me this very nice introduction back in 2019. And then when she asked me to speak here, I said we should have Thomas speak with me on this because his field is in that area. I would like to tackle it from starting at the back in the very last chapter. I loved his summary in the very last chapter on page 202. He's pretending he's a children's writer named Margaret Weiss Brown, and he says this is a summary of his book. The important thing about contempt is that it's bad for us. Sometimes we don't like people who disagree with us, and we want to tell them that they're idiots. And social media makes it easy to do so, and pundits get rich by doing it. And maybe it seems that some of them deserve our contempt. But the important thing about contempt is that it is bad for us. I love that. It was Martin in a book of sermons by Martin Luther King Jr. and the chapter on forgiveness. The name of the book is Love, A Strength to Love. And he says what we've heard many times, but when he first said it, I had never heard it. He said, a lack of forgiveness, and I would add contempt, is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. Contempt is bad for us. We're not ultimately in our true selves wired to be contemptuous. Jesus talks about contempt. He doesn't use that exact word, but I'm going to read a passage, and I hope I don't steal any thunder from Steve because it does come from the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus says this, you'll know it clearly. You've heard that it was said to the people long ago, you should not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you, and this is a key thing in the teachings of Jesus, that he reinterprets the Old Testament law or the Torah law. He says, but I tell you that anyone who's angry with his brother or sister will be subject to judgment. First it said murderers will be subject to judgment. He says, but I tell you, if you're even angry with your brother or sister, you'll be subject to judgment. And again, anyone who says to a brother or a sister, you empty-headed idiot, or in Aramaic, raka, is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, you fool, that's even worse, will be in danger of the fire of hell. So we've got two things here, anger and contempt. Jesus says, look, if you're angry, don't just not murder, don't even be angry, or you're in danger of judgment. But if you move from anger, which, by the way, does have some appropriate ways of being used, but they are not contemptuous. We'll look at those in a second. if you're angry, you're liable to judgment. But if it slips into contempt and you call somebody raka, and he takes these, continues to get to worse and worse slurs. When I was working my way through college, I worked for the Teamster. So I learned to cuss really well. And my guess is that Jesus was using a phrase right there that the truck drivers would have been very familiar with. If you call somebody you blankety blankety blank, you're in danger of hellfire. Dr. Dallas Willard, in his book on this, The Divine Conspiracy, he mentioned this exact place, and he said there are two twin evils in the world, anger and contempt. Anger is when you're mad at somebody because your will has been thwarted in some way. And contempt is when you slip. And boy, it's a slippery slope. It just takes a split second to move from anger to contempt. Contempt always puts you above the other person. And you're looking down at them. They're a little stupider. They're a little less informed. They're a little backward. They're evil. They're the other. And Jesus is very clear that these two things have no place in the life of a disciple. And a disciple, of course, is just a student of Jesus. The word disciple actually doesn't come from the root for discipline, which most people think it does. It just simply means, in the Greek form, it just means student, apprentice maybe would be another way to describe it. So as apprentices of Jesus, there's clearly no room for this kind of anger or contempt. The only right place for anger, best I can tell, is when it's against injustice. And when it's used in a nonviolent way. Even Jesus with his whip in the temple wasn't whipping people. He was driving out animals. He was performing a prophetic act against injustice. Now, if you look at the life of Jesus in the four Gospels, and you know, this is my kind of theme. I just wish people who name the name of Jesus would spend a little more time in the Gospels. But he's kind of the forgotten person in Christianity. How extremely weird is that? We're almost like the Holy Family. Remember when Joseph turns to Mary and says, you know, well, where's Jesus? I thought you had him. Well, I thought you had him. And, you know, the Holy Family left Jesus behind. That's really a bad idea. They're in charge of the salvation of the world, and they lose him for a few days. Well, Christianity, unfortunately, has done the same thing at times, lost the very person of Jesus, and somehow we've made Paul into our savior or some modern theologian into our savior. It's Jesus who died. It's Jesus who died on the cross. It's not the cross. It's Jesus. The good news is Jesus. So how, if we would just go back to those four Gospels and saturate ourselves in them, it would be so much better. I'm going to look at very briefly three or four places where Jesus clearly teaches us to move away from contempt. Remember, now he was part of a tribe. He was part of the nation of Israel, the 12 tribes of Israel. And they were a very tight-knit group of tribes, and they knew who they were and who weren't them. They, even today, you hear our Jewish friends talk about the goy, the outsiders. They are non-Jews. And to say that person's a goy in Jesus' day, or goyim, the plural, you know, is to say they are outside the bounds of our love, encouragement, fellowship. They're less than we are, etc. It had the same pejorative feel to it that some of our negative phrases are today. If you look at when Jesus called his 12 and then he took them, we tend to think he just took them around Israel, but that's not true. He very intentionally went outside the borders of Israel and met people within the borders of Israel who were not Jewish, and I think clearly to teach his disciples a lesson of that we are to love, not to be contemptuous. In Mark 5, I'll just tell you the story. He goes across the Sea of Galilee. There's a storm, but it takes him across the sea. And when it says they got out on the other side, what you don't know if you're not familiar with Bible maps and, you know, the nation of Israel and those days, is they were outside the nation of Israel. They were in the what's called the Decapolis, or the Gerardine area. These were non-Jewish people. And his disciples would have thought, don't take us over to be with those idiots, contempt, with those goy, contempt, with those unclean people. Isn't it interesting, whenever we have an enemy, we start even using words like unclean or dirty. I remember when I invited the now bishop of part of Palestine to speak at Westmont, and he said, you know, I am often called a dirty Palestinian. It's interesting that we, when we stick dirty or unclean on there, we become clean and they become unclean. Jesus went to the unclean people in the Gerardines. His disciples must have been going, Lord, let's not land. Turn the boat around. Let's get back to Israel with our folks, with our peeps, you know, with our homies, you know, let's get back. He not only gets out of the boat, but then he's met by a raving madman, a demoniac, full of demons in their cultural understanding of things. And the disciples must have thought, we told you, Lord, this is not a good place. These are not good people. And the guy comes out from the tombs, and he's been chained up there. He's so got superhuman strength. He's slashing himself with rocks, self-abusing, a poor psychotic mess. And Jesus heals him. Jesus heals him. And there's this wonderful line at the end of that where it says, the town fled, you know, they went, the shepherds or the people saw the pigs, he threw the demons into the pigs, good Jewish act. And then they went off a cliff and the folks went back to town. And during that time, they clothed this naked demoniac who is now healed. We don't know his name. I call him the formerly demonized man. And they find him clothed and in his right mind. All the people who knew he was such a danger, and it says, and they were really afraid now. They were more afraid of him when he was sane than when he wasn't. They kind of knew what to do with him, chain him up out in the cemetery, which is what they'd done. Jesus' disciples learned that this demoniac from the other side of the lake, from the other group of people that they despised, was a human being and had the Imago Dei. In Matthew 15, Jesus takes them up outside of Israel to the north, and he meets a Syrophoenician woman. You'll remember this very strange story, and I probably won't answer the question you all want to know the answer to in this story, but, you know, she's begging Jesus to heal one of her children and daughter, if I remember correctly, Jesus keeps, it looks like he's just kind of pushing her aside, which is exactly what a Jewish person would do with a Syrophoenician woman if they were being that way. And maybe Jesus was showing his disciples, this is the way you treat people. But the woman, so brilliant, so articulate, he says, Lord, he says, look, I've just come for the lost tribes of Israel. And she says, yes, I'm shortening the story, but she says, yes. But and he says, you know, it's not right to feed, give the dogs the food that the children deserve. And she says, which sounds like a very prejudiced statement. I think Jesus was showing his disciples, this is what you would say to this woman. And then she says, yes, Lord, but even the dogs under the tables deserve the crumbs. So she's accepting this label. She's humbly. And it says, a fascinating thing, it says, he was amazed at her faith. He was amazed. You know, the word amazed is used mostly about people who see Jesus. They're amazed at his teaching and at authority. They're amazed that he could heal. They're amazed at this 11 times in the Gospel of Mark. It says they were blown out. Their minds were blown. They were stunned. It's the same word. But in two places, Jesus uses this phrase. He doesn't actually use it in this exact one, but it's certainly the intent. You have great faith. Your daughter is healed. But in the next one, I'm going to tell you, he uses the word. He's coming down off the Sermon on the Mount. A centurion comes up to him. There's three versions of the story in the Gospels. And he wants his servant healed. His servant would have been a Jewish man, more likely a slave or an indentured servant at the very least. And so this Roman centurion, despised by the Jews would have been completely contemptuous of this person. comes and says, Jesus, would you heal? And Jesus basically, through his action, says, yes, let's go. And the guy says, no, you don't even have to come to my house, because I know that a Jew can't even come into the house of a non-Jew. I don't want to embarrass you in front of your people. I'm a man under orders. You just give the word and my servant will be healed. I know you can heal him from here. Now, and Jesus says he was stunned by, he was amazed by the faith of this non-Jew who everyone else would have held in contempt. And he said, I've never seen such great faith in all of Israel. He uses the contemptuous, the one who, on whom the Jews would have had contempt, as an example of radical trust, which of course is the entire theme of the Gospel of John, is that we would have radical trust in God and in Jesus and in the Spirit. And then lastly, of course, probably the most famous one, the Samaritan woman in John 4. See, Jesus is educating his disciples on anti-contemptness. I mean, he is saying, if you're one of my followers, this is not how you behave. The Samaritans, as you well know, and the Jews not only didn't get along, I mean, this was bitter hatred. In fact, the Samaritans, I forgot, I think it's like 50 years before the Gospels, before Jesus, had drug dead bodies into the temple to desecrate it. I mean, this was not a friendly relationship between Jews and Samaritans. And we all know from Sunday school lessons that Jews would always go around Samaria. You had Judea in the south, you had Galilee in the north, and Samaria kind of split them, and the Jordan River's over here. Jews would never walk through Samaria. They would go around it. And there's this wonderful verse in the Gospels that says, and Jesus was traveling with his disciples and they had to go through Samaria. And when you read that, you say, no, they didn't have to. In fact, no Jew would go through Samaria. What do you mean they had to go through Samaria? They did have to go through Samaria because Jesus' love was not just for his tribe. It went beyond his tribe. And he had to go through Samaria. He also had to teach his disciples something. And when he met with the Samaritan woman, as she's come to be called, they had this tremendous conversation. And he talks about the springs of living water that would flow up into her life, and that her broken life was not, it wasn't working out. He talked right to her need. He talked right to her, which was unheard of, a male speaking to a female in public, a Jew speaking to a Samaritan in public, a Jewish man speaking to a Samaritan woman who had been married 5 times and was living with somebody else. Now, he treats her with great respect, but he takes her on, and she loves it. And if you really read the dialogue, it's fascinating. He'd sent his disciples away. And they came back and saw him talking to this woman, and they're blown away. Then he starts teaching them, and the woman goes and gets the whole village. So now it was bad enough he was talking to one Samaritan and a woman at that, and a woman with a bad reputation at that. Now she brings the entire village, and they're streaming out to Jesus, all these non-Jewish people. And here's what Jesus says. Look, I think he's pointing to the people coming. The fields are white unto harvest. See, he didn't see Samaritans coming. He saw human beings coming. He saw human beings longing for these springs of living water. So this is the way Jesus thought, and this is the way Jesus lived. He said it, and he demonstrated a non-contemptuous life. And he says in some place in John, can't remember exactly where it says, I think it's in the Upper Room Discourse, he says, you know, the student should be where the master is. In other words, what he does, we are meant to do. John later said in his first letter, he said, anyone who says that they are in Christ must walk as Jesus walked, must live as Jesus lived. Or to put it in Dallas Willard's wonderful phrase, we're meant to live our lives the way Jesus would live our lives if Jesus had our lives to live. That's a mouthful. Let me say it again. Jesus, we should live our lives the way Jesus would live our lives if Jesus had our life to live. And he's meant to have our lives to live, right? We're supposed to have surrendered our lives to Jesus. So I'm meant to live Bart Tarman's life the way Jesus would live Bart Tarman's life, not Billy Graham's life or Tim Burnett's life or Pat McClure's life. I'm supposed to live Bart Tarman's life. And wouldn't it be a shame if we didn't show up at the end of our life, if for some reason we never actually showed up in it? You know, we're given a life. Wouldn't it be terrible if we didn't actually show up in our own life and become a more Christ-like version of who we are meant to be? So that's our goal. And I think I'll stop there and turn it over to Thomas.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. So let me get an aspect of time. So it's 10:35 now. So until when can I speak? What is the timeline?
We've got about 15 minutes, so until 10:50.
Okay, until 10:50. Okay, great. Okay. So thank you once again for the invitation. And it was really good that Bart gave the scriptural roots of what, how to live a life that is not contemptuous, that is given by Christ. And I want to, it dovetails very well into some of the reflections that I had in prayer. That is, you see, when we talk about ourselves, I assume that most of us are from a mature level. We are not exactly in the night of our lives, but neither are we in the morning of our lives. We are more, maybe Tim looks very young. Probably he must be in the early morning of his life. He looked like a teenager. But the rest of us probably are more in the afternoon or in the evening of our lives. So I'm conscious of that in this discussion, in this reflection. Long time ago, when I was living in a monastery in England, we always took care of, we had to take care of the members of the community who were in wheelchairs. And when it came to dinner time, we all had our dinner together. And sometimes we had to wheel them to the refectory, as it was called. And then there was this man who told me something that stuck in my heart until now. And he said, you know, he was talking about, and we were reflecting about some of the issues that plagued England at that time, about racism, about some of the questions like here in the US. And he said something like this. He said, there are many clouds in our skies now. But I want to tell you, may you personally have many clouds so that you will have a beautiful sunset. You see, Santa Barbara in the fall has some of the most beautiful sunsets because the clouds are so colorful. And if you don't have clouds, there is no color, except for the blue sky. So, you know, we are in the evening of our lives, and we have gone through the experience of this journey called life. And we are not teenagers, but we remember our teenage years. We remember what we did in our 30s and in our 20s, in our teens, in our 40s, and for some of us in our 50s, you see. And I am 73 years old, you see. And so Tim is smiling there. So I want to share with you at this stage. So we are aware of not so much life as a single person, as an individual, as we conceive in the United States. We know what it is to grow up in a family. We know how to go away from a family and how to make our own family and how to make a living, we know. We know how to sin. We know how to be angry. We know how to reconcile. We know how that. We know how to be successful. And now we are looking at something. We are asking some deeper questions, you see. And that's where I am, that I want to share with you. You see, when we talk about, I'll give you an example, something that has been happening in my life, especially during the last 20 years. You see, this is the season of ants in Santa Barbara. I don't know whether you have that issue in your homes. When it gets very hot, the ants leave and come to the shelter of our homes. And they are everywhere. I thought they are only in the bathrooms and in the kitchen. Today I found in my clothes closet, they are there, you know. And I watched these ants, not today. You would always notice that they are in a line, you see. And very seldom you would see an ant that is on its own, you see. We are also, I'm beginning to realize that we are also like these ants. And we somehow follow each other, like the birds at the ocean. We are together. And when we go away from that togetherness, we get lost. So why do I say that? The reason is that, you know, as Bart said, as Jesus really taught us, that there is a deeper meaning to life than what we were taught and that what we grew up as men and women of our day. The culture into which we are born tells us how to walk, what to eat, what not to eat, what language to speak, what values to have, what values not to have, what values are more important. We have grown up with that, you see, those values. And when we come to the interesting thing is when we come to the evening of our lives, we find that some of those values are poisonous, that we have been taking poison, that some of those attitudes and understandings are untruthful, you see. So for instance, when I studied in Europe, in Italy and Germany and England, you know, I learned in a way that success is very important, you see. That is the most important thing that you have to do, you see. And you have to be single-minded in that. You learn that. But you find, I find now, as much as it is important, I have become a different person. I am not what Bart listed for us as the values that God says is important. So for instance, to give you an example, we are talking about, you know, love your enemies. It's a tall order, you know. All those people who are for Trump and against Trump in our country, we are at crossroads in our culture. We are at a breaking point in some ways in our culture, you know, very similar to where I come from, a country that was, 2,500 years of history and civilization. The country came apart in 1956, like what is happening here, you see. And it has never come back. It has never healed. It went down and down and down and down. And a similar country like Singapore that wanted to be like Sri Lanka in 1959 went up and up and up because they found a way to heal the problem. So it is a very difficult time in the United States. I want to not actually negate the problem. There is a serious issue, but that is not what we are going to talk here. So I want to tell you some of the intimate things, you see, that, for instance, when I talk about contempt, we think that loving our enemies, I generally believe that I never hate my enemies. I live peacefully with other people. I generally don't get angry easily. You see, I have a lot of self-control. I don't talk about myself. I think I'm humble, right? You see, I have a family. I'm not divorced from my wife. So that means we are okay, right? My children are doing well and they are very loyal. We are happy family, you know. But, you know, if you scratch underneath that surface, you know, when you learn to live with Jesus, as I am learning now, it's a different world. To begin with, I know I have a few minutes left. So when I begin with Jesus, you see, Jesus's life, he calls us. I find that I have prejudices against my wife, even after so many years of marriage. And I don't realize it. I sometimes don't value her so much, you see. And there are qualities among my friends with others that I disagree with or I dislike. I have a negative view of some people. I may not speak about it. You see, I find somebody who is not very grateful to me for the things that I have done because I require gratefulness from people. You see, I require things that they cannot give me. You see, what I learned, what Jesus is teaching me these days is, you see, he became so humble that even as St. Paul says, to the death of the cross, he blessed those who crucified him. Oh my goodness, can I ever do that? Can I live blessing people irrespective of their views? Can I bless life? You see, and I'm learning these days, you know from where? I'm learning from the trees, you see. The trees tell us they are the scriptures of the world. They are the divine, as the Hindus would say. They are the divine. You can see that in the Old Testament, why it is called Mount Zion. God is supposed to inhabit the mountains. Why did God reveal himself to Moses in the burning bush? You see, you can see this, that all around us is the divine. Is, you see, the word God is an is not a good word. Actually, the old word for God from which it came is, God is originally called good, the good. You see, that is the name of God, you see. So, am I coming up to time? I think it's exactly time. So I want to sort of complete this. Probably during the discussion, we'll take it further, that there is a way of living as we come to the evening of our lives, that we realize through this journey that God is calling us to these golden years, not so much to enter the, to go travel around the world, but to travel into the journey of God's life, of divine peace, of divine reconciliation. So I'll stop there now. Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas. Thank you, Bart. All right, friends, I'm going to paste some questions in the chat for you here that you will be heading into breakout rooms to discuss for the next 20 minutes. The algorithm of Zoom will randomly assign you to a group of 3 to 4 folks that you'll be hanging out with until about 11:10. And then you'll have to accept an invitation to go to that room. And then at about 11:10, you'll automatically be brought back into this main Zoom room where we'll get to do some question and response with Thomas and Bart on today's presentation. So the questions for discussion in your breakout group are, number one, think of an example of your own experience with contempt, witnessing it around you or feeling contempt from another or feeling it rise up within yourself. How did you respond? And the second question is, how has this morning's presentation helped you to deal productively with our culture of contempt? Okay, so those are the two questions. They'll be there in the chat for you even when you go to your breakout room. And I'm going to assign you all right now to these rooms. There should be 4 people in each room, and maybe 3. But we'll be back around 11:10 or so. We'll see you soon. When this comes, you're going to have to accept the invitation right now. Hey, Thomas, go ahead. Yeah.
I have a question. And the question is, I want to ask each one of you, can you really, you growing up, especially if you had a good dad, a loving dad, you would call your dad daddy? My son, he purposely calls me my daddy. And he has a beautiful rhyme to that word, because there is a feeling that comes through when he says, my daddy. I want to ask you this question. When you talk with your daddy, I mean your real daddy, your daddy who conceived you in her womb, the divine daddy, how do you call him? Do you call him God? Do you call him divine? Do you call him my daddy? And there's a second part to the question too. How do you call your big brother, your good brother, you know, who loves you to pieces, who is your divine lover, Jesus? Do you call him Chris? For Christ? Do you call him Chris? You see, in my language, there is a loving way, just like daddy, to call your brother too. It's called Aya. You know? So I want to ask you that question. Because words show the nature of the relationships. Words are important. So I want to ask you that question.
If you'd like to respond to that, you just have to hit the unmute button on your screen. Feel free to just start speaking if you'd like to. And it might help to share your name if you begin talking.
That's a wonderful.
Yeah. You may want to mute your other device there.
Get it out of the room.
I would log out of the second one. While you're working on that, I do have a question in the chat. So this question is from Catherine, and she says, how do they suggest we respond, they, I think, meaning Thomas and Bart, in the face of the co-opting of Jesus and Christianity for political power and division, evoking Jesus, but then not acting in accord or embodying his teaching? Great question. How do you all suggest that we respond to this co-opting of Jesus and Christianity for political power in our country?
I'll take a shot at that because I think it's really important that we speak up, but it's important how we speak up. The Apostle Paul says in Ephesians, I think it's chapter 4, he says, speak the truth one to another in love. So we are to speak the truth as best we understand. None of us understands the truth perfectly. So there needs to be some humility and gentleness, caution maybe even. But we should speak up about that. Yeah, I think that's when Jesus is taken over for a political agenda, I mean, there's nothing much worse than religion that's not grounded in love. And often that's the case, I find, in some of the discourse we hear now. And I think it behooves those of us who've chosen to follow Jesus to speak up and say, you know, I don't see it this way. But we can do it with gentleness. We don't have to do it with harshness and certainly not with contempt. But we should speak up. Thomas, did you have a reflection on that question?
What reminds me, we were coming to the end of talking about Cardinal Dolan. So you notice that Cardinal Dolan is a very important cardinal, belongs, those of you who are not familiar with the Roman Catholic Church. He's the Archbishop of New York, and he came to give the prayer to the Republican Convention. And then I also saw some months ago that Pope Francis called out of all the priests and bishops and cardinals in the United States, he called an ordinary priest in a rural parish in Texas who was kneeling and praying at El Paso on behalf of migrant children. And he called all the way from Rome to this priest. And in my heart, I asked the question, for heaven's sakes, why has the Pope got to call this priest? because all his other priests and bishops and cardinals don't want to talk about justice. Cardinal Dolan found it okay to go and pray at the Republican Trump convention. What are we talking? So it is important, you know, I don't want to demonize any church or all churches, but when you look at history, and this is a very conflicting thing in my life, because, you know, having been a Catholic priest for a long time and trained at the Vatican and then now an Episcopal priest and teaching at an evangelical college for such a long time, 32 years, I feel so much part of my life is religion. I celebrate the Eucharist every day, and it is so much part of life, but I feel that religions are probably much worse than Donald Trump. They don't show their evil. Sometimes I feel, as Luther once said, religions are the Antichrist, you know, and because they, you see, it is like religions are like a vaccination. It vaccines you, it gives you a little bit of the disease of the Spirit of God to protect you against being born in Christ. You see, do I make sense to you that word? So it's a vaccination against God. And that takes me to an Indian guru that I was listening to recently. His name is Sadhguru, and he says, somebody asked him the question, don't you think that we should all come to the one way to have one faith so that we can all agree as God's love, as one family, one faith? And I was surprised by his answer, but I found great meaning in it. And he said, without batting an eyelid, he said, we should have millions and billions of religions, because every person's journey of the divine is different from each other. The journey of the divine in my wife is different than my own. Of my sons, they are different. Look at every creature, the trees, the leaves, the flowers. So I'll stop there.
So another comment we received in the chat was from Dennis saying, thank you, Thomas, for the daddy question. It's useful to think of the divine with a warmth.
Thank you.
Hey, and also, Yoli, I see a hand there, so you can feel free to share right now if you'd like.
Okay. I'd like to get back to your question, Thomas, about how we address God. And I am Roman Catholic. I am not Cardinal Dolan's type of Catholic. And as you know, we are not monolithic. But I really loved your question. And because what has happened to me in, I think, the autumn of my life, I do have to say it's always been there, because I grew up in a very mixed neighborhood in a religious family that was mixed. But what I love about the Roman Catholic Church is I can go to the saints. I can go to Mary. I remember being a young mother and realizing that God the Father and Jesus would not understand what I was going through as a young mother and the growth I was going through and the immense love that even surprised me that I could have for a child. Okay. But I knew that the mother of Jesus, the mother of God could. And so my prayers became to mother. And I've been thinking also just about the influence of Our Lady of Guadalupe on me throughout my life growing up in Southern California and how she has become to me a cultural icon of us working together and becoming together. And I go real internal now, and I don't mess with pronouns. It is when this is going to be when I need a man, I call on Father. When I need a woman, I call on a woman, and it's just funny to me, you know. But I'm answering your question honestly, and thank you for it. It's giving me food for thought.
No, you are a good teacher. You're very good. I like your answer. I like your answer. And if I may add, you know, in this evening of my life, I have found that I cannot redeem myself. You see, I am so chock-a-full. Is that the way you say it? Chock-a-full of faults and prejudices. And they are hidden because I'm intelligent. I can cover them up very easily, you know. So people don't see them. People see me as I was told, introduced, that I'm in this intellectual, that, you know, this good spiritual man and all that. So I can hide that very well. But I can see, and what is great about it is that in the sin that God, that this daddy, this Chris, who is my brother, gave up everything, loves me to pieces. That whoever I am, especially when I'm in a mess, that he would come, he would be with me. Those days I used to feel guilty. Now, when I get upset with my wife, I say, oh, Chris, help me out. I really cannot do this. So I cannot save myself. And I'm very happy that daddy, and I call the Holy Spirit mommy, you know, that's why I also call Mary. I love because Mary is also my mommy because she is the one in whom the complete Holy Spirit came upon in a human being. You see, behold, you are full of grace. Blessed is the fruit in your womb, Jesus. That's what the angel said, you see. So I love Mary. Mary is my mommy, but the Holy Spirit is my big mommy. Right. So it helps me. You see, it's not simply the words. It creates a family in me. And that family includes everyone, includes each one of you. Because imagine in the eternity of love that each of us is like a universe. And God's love is poured down on each of us, including Donald Trump, you see. Whatever happens, that we are in the loving womb of our Divine Mother, the Spirit of God. Thank you.
Yoli, I saw that you had a hand up. Would you like to ask something?
It's not really a question. It was when Dr. Tarman mentioned Matthew, I was going to say something about Matthew 13, but then I changed my mind now and will say something else. Dr. Arthur Brooks was in Carpinteria last November, 2019. And he mentioned something about, before he wrote the book, Love Your Enemies, he wrote many books that are statistics filled with data, what we would call boring books, if you are not a scientist or an economist or something like that. So he said that somebody wrote him an sent him an email, a very contemptuous email, starting with, you are a fraud, blah, 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 and then pointed out one piece by piece. And as he was reading this email, this contemptible email, something came up to him where, instead of being so angry at this email, he wrote back, he sent an email that says, I am so grateful you read my book. It's really, you know, I'm so grateful you read my book. I worked 2 years to complete this book. And so he sent that email with gratitude to that person. He got back an email from the person from Texas saying, whenever you go to Texas, please look me up and I will treat you to dinner. But the point of that is that love your enemies. Instead of reacting, which was in one of your, in your prompt, he reacted with kindness. And who would like to read a book that is so full of data and, you know, all of these things? It's really a very boring book. Yeah. So he was so, instead of reacting differently, instead of being so angry with this contemptible email, he reacted and answered very briefly with gratitude. And that changed the other person and emailed him back saying, when you go to Texas, look me up and I will treat you to dinner, you know. So that was his Love Your Enemies book. Mm-hmm. Love Your Enemies.
Well, I think we're about at our time. So Bart would like to make a final comment before we close, and then Pat McClure is going to close us out.
Well, one of you sent me a really kind private message asking a question or making the point. I hope I, in my presentation, you didn't misunderstand me to say the entire Jewish people were contemptuous of everybody else. If it came across that way, that certainly is not true, and it's not what I would have meant to say. However, their culture, just like our culture, had contempt baked into it in structural ways. And so Jesus, of course, was Jewish. He wasn't Christian. He didn't start the Christian religion. He was working in his own faith community to correct some of the abuses. And so that's what I'm talking about. So, in fact, I have a very dear friend from college, a Jewish man, and he listens to my sermons online. He's actually a Jewish scholar. And I've asked him, at least for my sermons, if ever he hears me say something that in any way sounds, you know, like I'm casting all Jewish people together, because my focus is on the New Testament, so there is a lot about the Jewish people. And so that's been helpful to me. So I think he might have made the same comment to me that one of the friends here did. So I just want to be clear on that. Jesus was trying to correct the abuses within his own culture and his own community. And I think that's what we're supposed to do within our own. So,
well, I think that I'm being cued. I want to thank Bart and Thomas for helping us do some deconstructing of this culture of contempt that we've watched rising around us. Thanks for giving us some keys to understanding all of this and some ways to move past our pointing fingers, maybe to make a respectful nod perhaps even an affectionate acknowledgement of the simple humanity of all those others who actually are a lot like us. Well, there's been such compelling information and insight offered by our speakers this morning that many of us are going to want to revisit this fine teaching. It's all been recorded, and it will be available in the next day or two on our website. Remember, the website is all one word, wordandlife.us. Next week, we'll welcome another of Word and Life's popular speakers, Reverend Steve Jacobson. Steve will be talking to us about some of the political implications of the Sermon on the Mount and the neuroscience and practice of caring for our enemies. And just a word to those who wince when those words politics and Jesus get close to each other. Remember, Jesus' own time was nearly as politically troubled as our own, and much of his teachings dealt with a radical new approach of thought and attitude whose inner chemistry literally changed the reality of the disciples as they walked with the people who opposed them.